Welcome to Let's Talk Specials, a special episode of the podcast by the Federation of Enterprises in Belgium. I'm proud to introduce our special guest today, Solitaire Townsend, an international sustainability expert, co-founder of award-winning change agency Futera, and a leading voice in the debate on climate change and the future of sustainability for businesses. As the author of the book The Solutionists, Solitaire Townsend truly believes companies can play a key role in solving social and environmental challenges through ambition, optimism, and concrete action. So together, we'll discuss how sustainability can create new business opportunities and become both strategic and profitable for you as an entrepreneur. Welcome to Let's Talk Specials. Solitaire.
Hello, Nathalie. It's so lovely to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. You are in Brussels now today. How are you? How was the trip?
It's a wonderful trip. The Eurostar is such an easy way to come from London to Brussels. And I walked through Brussels today, which was just wonderful to just get the sense of the place and the people. It's not my first time in Brussels, but I always find something new coming to the city.
Well, I'm really excited to have you as our new guest today on this special podcast episode. Today, we're going to talk about this story, this wonderful story of our sustainability in this world. And for that, I would like to ask you to take us all the way back. So could you step into a time machine with me? And let's just go back to the 1800s, basically, where I believe it was even two Englishmen who brought the Industrial Revolution to Belgium. John and William Cockerill built these big steel factories that would actually mark the beginning of our present railway system. And fast forward a few decades later, when we look around the world, well, you're also someone who travels a lot. You travel the world a lot. So let's do the same thing back then. And we see all those great inventions all over the world. And suddenly we have this great economic model that seems perfect at first sight. But unfortunately, that's not how this story ends. Knowing what you know today, what would you tell these gentlemen and all these inventors? What is the one thing that they looked over?
It's such a great question, and thank you, because this, we're getting into the real stuff here. We're getting into economic theory and capitalism and why the world works the way that it works. So I'm from the UK. A lot of economic theory, as you say, was born in the UK and in the rest of Europe at the beginning of the Victorian age. And of course, we had Adam Smith, who set out the fact that maybe the best way to help raise everybody up would be to count on people's selfishness rather than people's morality. And that maybe we might be able to create greater collective wealth through trade than through philanthropy within a very sort of a medieval system of kings, etc. And so the first thing I would say to those gentlemen, and they were all gentlemen back there, was be thank you, because they were right. Actually, industrialization, capitalism, there's enough meritocracy within that. It's not perfectly meritocracy, but there's enough meritocracy in it that it's bought incredible freedoms. It's bought the ability that, you know, I'm a woman from quite a poor background. I'm not someone's servant. I'm, you know, not barefoot and pregnant with, you know, 10 children. I have my own business and I travel the world and I've had an education. So the very first thing we need to acknowledge is an immense gratitude for the system with the win-win. I am a fan of capitalism, particularly with the freedoms that it brings. However, there's also a few things that those gentlemen didn't know. They lived in a very big world. Much of it had not even been explored yet. There was whole countries we hadn't yet seen. They hadn't yet seen the picture of Earthrise from space, the photograph that many of us saw again recently with the Artemis photographs. They had no idea how small the world they lived in really was. And so crucially, they thought that there was only two potential limits to the growth of the systems that they lived in. Labour, i.e. how many people at what price that you could get to work, and capital, how much money there was to invest and create new things. Those were the only two things that they considered limited. The world was unlimited. Of course, in the very, very brief period of time since then, we've discovered that it turns out that there are limits within nature, that there is only a certain amount of pollution that our systems can take, that there are only a certain amount of trees that we can grow, that there are resources that have limits, and that when you start getting to the edge of some of those limits, that they can cause great problems. So what I would say is, going back in time to the champions, you've got the most fantastic system, the best system, the system I would far, far prefer to live in capitalism than in feudalism, where the Lord owns everything and I just work for them. But you've missed a crucial part of how the economy is going to work. And that's the part that, because it's neglected within the system, because we don't think about it, because we don't price for it, because we don't recognise those limits in how we run our organisations, we're in danger of bringing down the very thing that they were trying to build. The very first and most consequential victim of something like climate change could be capitalism. And of course, the other thing about those gentlemen, love them as I do and grateful for them as I are, is that they weren't the most equitably minded either. they didn't realise the incredible resources of intelligence and entrepreneurship and invention that were available in people who didn't look like them. And so they lived in this world where they didn't realise that there were limits in the environment, and they also didn't realise that there was a lack of limits, and there was incredible, amazing ideas and passion and power within people who didn't look like them. And so those were the two issues, those social issues and those environmental issues. One of the things which I wish we could learn from them was how powerfully they believed in governance. And in, you know, they started writing the very first rules of reporting and corporate transparency far before governments even were doing any of that.
Up to this day, sustainability experts still argue that our growth model is too much, puts too much emphasis on the production, the productive capital, but not nearly enough on our people and nature. So it seems that to this day, when it comes to innovating and producing and manufacturing, it's still like the sky is the limit. But even that is no longer true, because now I read that humankind is looking into mining the surface of the moon, mind you. So where does it stop? Because back in the 60s, when they went to when we had the first moon landing, they found helium-3. And so now it is said that helium-3 could be the energy source of the future, and that 10 space shuttles full of helium-3 could provide a year of clean fusion energy for the whole world. So that sounds very promising, but I wonder, where are we going?
I love how much this conversation is about space and time. This is awesome. So I recently, just a few weeks ago, was at Hampton Court Palace in London. Hampton Court Palace was Henry VIII's favourite palace. Very big, very beautiful palace. And King Charles III, had gathered together a whole set of businesses to discuss his Astra Carta. And Astra Carta is a sustainability plan for space. So you had a lot of Blue Origin was there, and SpaceX, and governments was there, and the European Space Agency and NASA were there. And we spent a few days discussing Astra Carta, because there are extraordinary resources available in space. But there's also a huge question mark about the energy return on investment. So the amount of energy, the amount of effort that it takes to be able to bring some of those things down versus being efficient here on Earth. You know, I'm sure many of you have heard the British saying, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Mm-hmm. Basically, what you got is worth more than what you could get. And so we're putting all of these efforts and conversations in terms of going into space, where here on Earth, we already have huge abundance of resources. We just use them very inefficiently. So take, for example, the farming industry. We talk a lot about how on Earth are we going to be able to feed 8 billion, 9 billion, 10 billion people. So, well, we already waste a third of the food we currently produce. A lot of it is wasted in the fields, a lot of it rots in storage and in transportation, a lot of it ends up not looking perfect enough to sell on the shelves, and so the supermarkets reject it. And then even when it gets to our own homes, we don't always eat or cook it. But actually, the Royal Society in London said that we could easily feed, in a healthy, desirable diet, 12 billion people just from the food that we already produce. So whilst going out to space and searching for more resources is an exciting proposition, and I'm particularly excited by some of the proposition to actually not necessarily harvest resources, but harvest solar energy from space, that there's a lot of big plans to put some very significantly sized solar arrays in space and then essentially beam that energy down to Earth, which would be fantastic. I love those ideas. I'm one of those people who thinks that maybe we could just be a little bit of more efficient here on Earth first.
Well, you talk about inefficiency nowadays here on Earth. You've been in the sustainability business for so long. You have so much experience, which means that you basically got a front seat to all the evolutions and how the narrative also changed. Looking back, do you think it is now time for a new form of sustainability, or are we already in that era?
Oh, so we recently, my organisation Futera, we did a review of the waves of interest in sustainability. So the media coverage of the environmental issues, the social issues, the equity and human rights issues and the governance issues, we tracked back media coverage around the world from various sources back to 1960. And what you can see from 1960 is that there's waves up and down, wherein sometimes this is the thing that everyone's talking about and it's front page news and consumers care about it. And then other times it seems to go down in interest and it gets put behind other topics. Things that never goes away. And if you look at each down wave still has a greater level of interest and action than the previous down wave. So the overall trend is actually very high upwards. So at the moment, we are in a down wave compared to 2019 and 2020, where with Me Too and Black Lives Matter and Fridays for Future, there was this huge, huge, huge movement and energy, particularly towards the end of the pandemic, as everyone was sort of caring about each other and the planet. And almost always after every very extreme peak, there's always a drop. But where we are now in the down wave is far, far, far higher than the previous down wave. It's still like, I remember the down wave after the financial crash in 2008, where everybody, literally front pages were screaming, we can't afford to be good. And the previous era, we've been talking a lot about ESG, environment, social or society and governance. In the previous era, we were talking about CSR, corporate social responsibility. And everybody was saying we can't afford corporate social responsibility and CSR is over and the business of business is business in the last down wave. And then, of course, what happens is that the media swings one way and the media swings the other way. And so when I do the maths and measure between each peak, we're due for another peak to start in 2027. And I think that that will have a different flavour. The most recent peak was very much led by activism, particularly a lot of youth activism and street activism. Great, we always want young people to use their democratic right to protest. So a lot of that was happening, a lot of street activism. But it was also for corporates led by a lot of compliance, a lot of reporting, CSRD, CSDDD, all of these different rules that companies had to try to meet, this regulatory framework from the EU. There was a report from IBM that said that companies were spending more money on reporting reporting and compliance than they were on doing sustainability.
Exactly.
So I'm quite happy that that era has sort of come to an end. And I think that the next era upwards will be around what I call the solutions economy. So the previous economy that we're in has caused us some issues. There's issues around waste, there's issues around pollution, there's issues around energy, there's issues around equity, there's issues around education. We have a lot of issues within society. And I think the next big wave off of sustainability will be very entrepreneurial rather than managerial. So the current wave is managerial. It's very much about rules-based and structures and systems and reporting and transparency, all of which is good, but perhaps we went a little bit too far that way. The next wave up is going to be, how do you make money out of being good? How do you invent and create and sell the solutions that society is looking to the problems that it's facing? Perhaps a little bit less moralistic and compliance, and a little bit more exciting and opportunity-based.
Well, those are the questions that are so interesting for our listeners, our businesses here in Belgium. Solitaire, you published a book in 2023, The Solutionist, or how businesses can fix the future. And you call yourself a solutionist. I think that's such a wonderful word. But could you just quickly give a definition of the solutionist for us?
So I am a solutionist, and I changed my job title because I was co-founder of my organization 25 years ago. And I changed my job title to solutionist because every time I looked at my own job title, I wanted to be reminded of what it is that I wanted to do in the world. And a solutionist, the answer is in the question. A solutionist finds solutions to problems. So I'm an optimist, but I don't ignore the problems that we're facing. We've got we've got a great deal of social division that's happening. We have a big issue with a lot of youth disenfranchisement. We've got some very serious environmental issues going on, and we have some geopolitic global problems, many of which actually focus, might pivot on things such as climate change. There are problems. But as someone who's always been an entrepreneur, being a solutionist is about ways of finding and growing and scaling and monetizing those solutions.
Could you explain to our small business owners here in Belgium how they could become part of the solution rather than fixating on the problem?
I'm also a small business owner. So I've been running, Futera has been, from any depending on the year, anywhere between 5 to 15 million turnover. I have an office in London, in New York, in San Francisco, in Mexico City. I have about 70 people who work for me at any given time. Being a small business is hard. Like, you know, particularly if I remember the days when we were a micro business, where, you know, you're the secretary and the boss and the computer IT person and the person who helps pack the box. There's a lot on your mind when you're a small business.
A lot of pressure,
a lot of things you've got to take account of, a lot of sleepless nights, a lot of sense of responsibility, particularly to your own staff.
Towards the others, yeah.
But if there's one thing that every single small business is entrepreneurial. You can't be a small business without being entrepreneurial. In very large businesses, a huge number of people are middle management. Small business doesn't tend to have middle management. There's no safety net. There's no fat. There's no give. There's no people who are there just taking their salary and expecting to be there for 14 years. Everything's always about working on the edge. So things which I would say to small businesses is you have far more opportunity to invent the solutions than big businesses do. And then you can sell your solutions to the big businesses. I see this all the time.
I heard you speak about managerial sustainability early on. So you make the distinction in your keynote between managerial sustainability and entrepreneurial sustainability. Could you explain to us what that really means?
Yeah, so we need both. Just be absolutely clear. If we just have entrepreneurial sustainability, that's fantastic, but nobody will ever do their recycling. Nobody will ever do their energy management, and there'll be no transparency. But if we only do managerial sustainability, then every dot will be dotted, every T will be crossed, we'll have all of the data that we need, and companies will be managing down their impacts, but we'll never have any more solutions. So the best organizations have both. They have managerial sustainability to set their goals, their targets, their reporting, their day-to-day, particularly things such as using sustainability to identify energy savings, using social sustainability to ensure employee motivation, etc., so that there's a good, solid, responsible and continuous space of action. But they also have managerial, they also have entrepreneurial teams who are able to generate new ideas. So I encourage every business to, you know, make sure that your house is in order and that you're thinking about ways in which you can reduce your negative impact, but also think about ways that you can increase your positive. How can you do more good? How can you invent and create and build new businesses to solve the problems, not just trying to be less a part of the problem?
So entrepreneurial sustainability is the way to go, by focusing on sustainability as a source of new products, new ideas,
yes,
new business models, new markets. And so our businesses should focus more on innovation and growth and try to find small solutions, think small, but then eventually...
And then grow them big.
Sell big.
And there's huge opportunities. So every time there's a giant market shift, that comes with winners and losers. And we really don't want to be losers within the market shift. And, you know, everyone's talking about AI at the moment as being this giant market shift, which it is. And, you know, there will be winners and then losers, and there'll be giant bubbles in AI. People are trying to use AI for everything at the moment, and it will be proven extremely useful in some areas and really, really kind of not as useful in others. And so there'll be winners and losers on that. But of course, particularly environmental issues are also a giant market shift. We are locked into at least 10 to 15 years of climate change now. There will be, Europe is also heating faster than anywhere else on the planet. Europe is heating faster than Africa, then heating faster than South America, heating faster than Asia. Europe is going to have much more extreme weather events. That's very, very, very serious. And it's also a huge opportunity and a needed opportunity to help people navigate that, help people live well in that, help people be well within it. I was talking to a company that makes household goods very recently, and, you know, things such as toasters and microwaves and etc. And they work, a lot of their products generate a lot of heat when you use them. They pump out a lot of heat into the home. You know, you'd think in sort of England that wouldn't be much of a problem. That would be welcoming, you know, we would all be gathered around the toaster trying to warm our hands. But actually in the UK, we're now regularly getting 35 or 40 degree heat. This is something our homes are completely not built for. And the products in our homes generating more heat is a real problem. So actually for this company, it's a huge opportunity for them to produce very energy efficient products. So, you know, less carbon, more energy efficient, helping consumers save money on their energy bills, but also products that can toast without heating up the whole house. And so this is where there's a win-win. There's a win for the environment and a win for people. And when you've got a giant market shift like some of the ones that we're facing and which we're locked in for the next 15 years, you either ignore it, you try to carry on regardless, or you go, right, people are going to need a lot of solutions. What can I bring to market that can help people live in a different way? Because that's going to be coming for us. And how can I actually help people make a benefit and a lifestyle out of it? What I'm really hoping is that everybody's listening and have got like one or two ideas that are beginning to brew in their idea. I'm hoping that people might be grabbing notebooks, might be taking a couple of thoughts on their phone of going, what ideas do I have if this is all coming and changing? What might I bring to market? How might I be a solutionist multi-millionaire, someone who makes a great deal of money out of saving the world?
So what we really need is a mind shift among our businessmen and business women, because sustainability doesn't have to be hard or this big problem that is impossible to solve, but could be the source of new business. Solitaire, you very often stress the fact that we need to stay positive. You're really fighting doom thinking. You do not like that. How do you think that being positive can be a business strategy.
So I have a master's degree in environmental science. I am very close and good friends with a number of climate scientists and biodiversity scientists. I work around the world with people who work on some extreme social issues, including sort of child labour and issues of exploitation. You'd think I'd be really depressed because I know exactly how bad things are and could be. And I talk to the people who track these problems to a great degree. But when I ask scientists about how they feel about everything, they're not depressed about the science. They're depressed about the politics. They actually can see that not only is it possible for us to deal with climate change, we could even reverse parts of global warming. There would still be climate effects, but we could bring ourselves back down to 0.5 degrees of warming within a human lifetime.
We are now at 1.5.
1.5. There's controversy about whether we've passed the 1.5 or not right now, but there's very little controversy about the fact that we will. Like, you know, we're pretty locked in we're very likely to reach at least 1.8, even if we do everything which we care about. But the scientists are very bullish and excited about the ability of nature to actually regenerate and reverse, that the oceans have got this extraordinary ability to stabilize our planet. What they're worried about is the fact that we're not going to do everything which we can. And that's an incredible hopeful story for me. I feel very, very positive about that because I think we fundamentally don't understand how fast we can change, how fast our societies can change. So when I did my master's in sustainability, renewable energy was a joke. We called it alternative energy. It was something that there'd been a few little examples of, and that, you know, that Jimmy Carter had put a couple of solar panels on the White House, and then Reagan had taken them down. It was this slightly strange, and it was even called alternative energy. I was part of the team that helped rebrand it to renewable energy. The idea that in my lifetime we might get to the point where 30, 50% of the UK's electricity would be generated by renewables was laughable when I was doing my master's degree. We thought it was 100, 150, or 200 year transformation that it would take to get there. The idea that renewable energy would be the cheapest energy on the planet, it was a factor 30 more expensive back then. It literally was something that people did almost as a scientific experiment to show what might be possible. And yet just last year, China bought online, switched on the same amount of renewable energy in China as the equivalent of the entirety of Europe's annual energy consumption. So the transformation has been extraordinary. And again, we've lived through that. And yet when I survey people in the UK and I ask them how much of our electricity do you think we get from renewables, I'll say 3 or 4%, when it's actually 30 to 50%. And I can tell you something, the UK is really windy. So we could just stick a whole load of wind turbines around the edge and we could be a net exporter of energy. So these transformations happen so quickly around us. And yet there's this human condition where we seem to think that it's not possible for those transformations to happen, and we get very doomist about it. And I'm like, well, if being a doomist motivates you to take action, great. But I think for most people, it doesn't. I think for most people, thinking that these issues are too big and too impossible, and they get grumpy and cynical about it, I think that actually tends to stop people doing things.
We feel powerless.
You know, it's a bit cool to be like, oh no, we can't do anything and everything's dreadful and the politicians will never let us and everything's going to hell. Whereas actually being a little bit optimistic, and I have a very naughty campaign at the moment, which you can look up online, which is F word doom, which is fuck doom. Oh yeah, I forgot we're in Europe. I'm allowed to say I'm recently in the US when you're not allowed to talk like that. But the fuck doom campaign is all around the fact of going, no, enough. I'm not having this. Like, it particularly, I'm not having it from a bunch of extraordinarily privileged, protected people in the global north, when actually the impacts that will be felt are primarily being felt by people in the global south. No, we've lived through changes. And also, One of the things which, a wonderful a quote that I read many years ago said, most of the suffragettes, the women who protested for the right to work, to the right to vote, most of them died before the actual global enfranchisement. Most of the folks in the US, the civil rights movement, who marched for equity, never saw the first black president. The inventors of electricity died by candlelight. Their deathbeds were lit by candlelight rather than the inventions that they'd created. Maybe those of us who are a little bit older won't always see some of these solutions that we're bringing online change the world. It doesn't mean it's not worth doing, because everybody who's listening and me, when we look at the children in our family, all of us want their lives to be better than ours. All of us want them to have more choices, more opportunities. We want to be proud of them. When we're older, we want to look at them and kind of feel a bit smug about how great we managed to make things for them. And that is so possible still.
Yes, so our businesses can definitely contribute to a better world. For my final question, I would like to ask you, if you could correct one fundamental misconception about sustainability among business leaders, what would it be?
The number one thing I would correct in sustainability would be thinking that sustainability belongs to the activist and NGO community. I love the activist and NGO community. They are an early warning signal for anything that's coming down the line. I love the morality. I'm part of it. You know, many of the big organizations like WWF and others are my clients. But sustainability equally belongs to the business community, because the activists, the NGO community, tell us what's wrong and point out what needs solving. And the business community brings those solutions, monetizes them, and works out the economic path to take them to scale. So that's the thing, which is stop thinking that this topic is a topic you should feel guilty about, and start feeling that environmental and social challenges are something that you should feel excited about. And don't for one second feel guilty about making a shit ton of money out of it, because unless and until we replace capitalism, that's the way that things get to scale. The more money you can make out of saving the world, the more likely is that you're going to do so. So I would love people to sit there, draw a big old euro sign, underline it a couple of times, and then work out exactly what solution they are going to bring to market that's going to save the world and make them a millionaire.
Solitaire, thank you so much for being on our show. It was so lovely having you.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. It's so great to be here. Thank you so much.
And thank you for those solutions that could actually really help our businesses move along, think further than just reporting driven tactics, and just start building real strategies and find new solutions to the sustainability issue. Thank you so much.
Brilliant. Thank you.
And this concludes this special episode of our podcast, but we'll be releasing a new episode very soon in our Let's Talk series, brought to you by the Federation of Enterprises in Belgium. So don't forget to activate those notifications in your favorite podcast app. I am your host, Natalie Bay, and until next time, stay tuned.